Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. In this part of the show, we'll be talking about how it is that infants try to make sense of the world around them. And particularly, we'll be talking about some of the kind of research that has been going on now over, roughly speaking, about the last 20 years, trying to get a better understanding of that. And one of the things that seems to have come across is that, to put it in a very plain sort of way, that babies are a lot smarter than we once thought. And that they are, in fact, very good and careful observers, and that they're, from a very young age, are trying to figure out the world and how it works. And, in fact, one might argue that they come with a better understanding already ready to go than we had thought, and that babies just that might be 6 months old are actually pretty smart. And you can tell that by designing experiments and testing them. And we'll be talking this morning with a psychologist here from the University of Illinois, Rene Baillargeon, who's been doing that kind of work for a long time, something like 20 years. As we talk, questions, comments certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and also toll-free, that's 800-222-9455 at any point here. If you'd like to call in, ask a question, you're certainly welcome to do that. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
The sort of example that I in the short promotional announcement that I put together to talk about the program, the example I gave was one that maybe people are familiar with to get them to think about what it is we're talking about. And it's this kind of idea. That is, if you take an adult and sit them down and you show them something, say you show them a teddy bear, you say, here, look at this teddy bear, and you put it down on the table in front of them, and then you take a box and you put it over the teddy bear so they can't see it anymore. Adults know it's still there. It's just that it's mm-hmm. under the box and it hasn't ceased to exist. It's there. For a long time, apparently, we had this idea that infants somehow, if they couldn't, we had this idea that if they couldn't see it anymore, that somehow for them it ceased to exist. That they didn't have that understanding that an adult would have is that, well, just because I can't see it doesn't mean it's not still there. At some point, it was argued that, in fact, yes, that's one of those things that you learn. Because mom goes out of the room, that doesn't mean mom doesn't exist anymore. And if the teddy bear is covered up and I can't see it, that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. And one of the things that I think one of the basic sort of questions that you have tried to do and others who have done this kind of research is, well, when at what point do we learn that do we master that skill? Do we get the idea that just because we can't see that thing, it doesn't mean it goes away? And what you have argued with your work is that, in fact, at a quite a young age, before they're old enough to talk about this sort of thing with us, that babies get it. They know that that thing mm-hmm. is still there.
Mm-hmm.
How, given the fact that you can't engage in conversation with them, how do you go about trying to test an idea like that and figure out what it is that they do, in fact, know?
Well, in fact, babies make it very easy for us because what we do is take advantage of a natural response they have, which is that babies tend to look longer at events they view as unexpected than at expected events. And of course, as adults, we still have the same response. That's why we enjoy magic shows, for example, where we're shown a series of unexpected events. So to go back to your example, in the old days, which is, for example, when I was a college student, the way you tested this idea that objects exist when hidden with babies, it's often called object permanence. The way people tested it was to see at what age babies would lift the box to find the teddy bear underneath it. And what researchers typically found is that they don't do so until about 8 months of age. But then investigators started to think that the reason why younger infants don't lift the box to see the teddy bear may be not because they don't understand that the teddy bear exists, but because they don't quite know how to go about lifting the box. They don't quite know how to retrieve the teddy bear. So what we needed were sort of new ways of testing young babies whose actions are very limited. And we decided to take advantage of this fact that babies, like us, look longer at surprising or unexpected events. So, for example, in our lab, what we might show young babies is events where a teddy bear is covered with a box, and then a hand lifts the box, and in the expected event, there's the teddy bear, and in the unexpected event, the teddy bear is gone. And what we find is that very little babies, babies as young as 2.5 months of age, actually will look longer when the teddy bear is gone than when it's there, suggesting that they know there should have been a teddy bear there, or that's actually saying it too strongly. There should have been an object there, and they're surprised that there's now no object. So we now think that understanding that objects exist when hidden is actually something that's very likely to be innate, since it's present already by 2.5 months of age. Hmm. So nature has helped babies make sense of the world around them by giving them sort of a very shallow causal framework to sort of orient them to events, to help them understand them. And the idea that objects persist in time and space is one of these causal ideas that will sort of help them begin to make sense of the world. Babies' problems is that when they see events, they often represent very little information about them, and they have to learn what to pay attention to make sense of events. So in your teddy bear example, what a very little baby will represent is closed object under box. That's all they will represent. And so what that means is that if you cover a teddy bear and when you lift the cover, it's a duck, babies at 2.5 months won't be surprised because it's still a closed object. So as time goes on, babies learn sort of to better what to pay attention to better understand events, to better predict their outcomes. So little by little, they'll start to represent the size, the shape, the pattern, the color of objects. And then they'll detect finer and finer violations. Mm.
Well, I think that that's still very interesting that even very young babies, they understand the concept of they're a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that they're, that we'll put this the box over the thing, and that they'll still have the idea that that thing, it's still there,
mm-hmm.
and that when you, if you do the trick on them, so you pull away the box and it's not there, that they'll do probably what an adult would do. They'll stare at that space, mm-hmm. and they'll think, wait a minute, there was a thing there,
mm-hmm.
that still should be there. Mm-hmm. What, you know, what happened to that thing?
Yeah, completely. It's very it's really wonderful to see how much, you know, very little babies already know about the world around them. You know, how sophisticated they are. You know, 20 years ago, babies were described by Piaget, the famous Swiss psychologist, as sensory motor processors who had perceptual abilities, abilities to perform simple actions on objects, and that was it. And it's really, there's been this revolution in the last 20 years where we realize that actually babies are much more sophisticated than we thought, as you were suggesting mm-hmm. earlier.
Well, why did it take us 20 years to figure that out?
I think it's in large part because, well, there are two issues. The main issue is probably methods. So Piaget, when he was observing babies, so Piaget's ideas about babies came mostly from observations of his three babies. And he was a wonderful observer of babies. He has very detailed descriptions that are really just amazing. But nevertheless, all he observed were their actions on objects. And because very little babies' actions are so limited, there wasn't much to, you know, you couldn't really draw very rich conclusions about what they thought about the world. So now we have better methods, more sensitive methods, like in our experiments, what we compare is their looking times at different events, and this has proven to be a very, very sensitive method of what babies view as expected and unexpected. Mm-hmm. So that's a big part of it. The other part of it is that, you know, Piaget very early in his career came to the conclusion that there were radical transformations taking place in intellectual development during infancy and childhood. He loved the idea that there are these metamorphoses of the mind that occur where you have one way of construing reality and then your mind undergoes a metamorphosis and has richer structures to deal with the world. And because he was so wedded to this idea, he never saw development as continuous or gradual. He wanted to see these deep discontinuities over time. And the model we have today, like for example in my lab, is a much more Chomskyan model based on Noam Chomsky's work that you have rich innate structures. They're still limited, but you still have rich innate structures that guide your thinking about objects, your thinking about people. And so you view development in a much more gradual, continuous way. Babies have lots and lots and lots to learn about the world around them, but the basic structure that they use to think about the world and learn about it is kind of given to them by nature.
Mm-hmm. And you feel confident that the main measure that you're using, that is the amount of time the baby looks, that's a good enough indicator, since you really don't know what's going on, you really don't know what's going on inside, that's a good enough indicator so that you would say, I'm fairly certain that, for example, to go back to the example that we talked about, you'd be fairly certain that what's going on here is that there was one expectation, and that something happened that was not what was expected, and that's leading to puzzlement, I guess. You feel fairly certain you're pretty sure what it is that's going on inside the baby's head when the baby just spends a lot of time just staring at the blank space where he or she was expecting the teddy bear to be and that there wasn't anything.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a very good question. In fact, many people have asked this question about their findings since, you know, what we're proposing is so radically different from established dogma, so to speak. Many people have scrutinized our method and have been skeptical of it. So there's really two ways that we can deal with the question that you raise. So one way is to show babies many different events. And if we get sort of consistent results across the events, then you start to be more convinced that maybe we're tapping something real. So, for example, you may cover a teddy bear and uncover it, and the teddy bear is gone. You may have, for example, you have like a little mouse that goes behind a screen and reappears from behind a different screen, and babies find that very surprising. You may have an object that you place in a container, and then you tip the container and the object is gone. So you show them not just one event, but many different events involving some inert objects, some self-propelled objects that move by themselves. And as you sort of test the same age babies with many different events, and whenever you show them an event where something that existed is no longer there, or something that it did not exist is now there, if babies view all of these events as unexpected, then it's unlikely that they're responding to a low-level feature of the events. So that's one way to address it. The other way to address it is to look for converging evidence with other methods. So part of what we've done here is to develop, especially following the work of one of my postdocs, Sue Hespos, what we've been doing is to develop these very simple action methods, much simpler than the ones Piaget used, that again sort of provide converging evidence. So we can test babies as little as, let's say, 4 to 5 months of age with them. And here's an example. You show babies a very tall frog and you allow them to play with it. So we always use things like, you know, ducks and frogs and teddy bears because we need our babies to be interested by our objects. You know, they really have to want them and want to play with them. So here we use a tall frog. And the baby plays with it for a while. Then we place it behind a very tall screen. We sort of hide everything. And then when we remove this screen, babies see, a small like they see two screens. One is very short and has little frog feet coming out of it, and the other one is tall and has frog feet coming out of it. And the question is, where will babies believe that our tall frog is hidden? Behind the short screen with the little feet or behind the tall screen with the little feet? And by about 3.5 months of age, babies know to pay attention to height in these kinds of events. And so babies, in a sense, think to themselves, of course, this is all unconscious, but they think to themselves, I'm looking for a tall frog. A tall frog could only be hidden behind the tall screen. So they sort of reach for the tall screen to find the tall frog. So this is a very simple action. They reach, you know, to one side for the short screen or to the other side. And what we measure is which side do they reach for, a very simple action that even a very little baby can perform. So even 4.5-month-old babies will reach for the correct screen in this case. So these are simple actions that provide converging evidence for their responses in these other tasks, these looking time tasks.
I think this is really fascinating that we should now have this appreciation for the fact that, well, indeed, as you say, while babies, there are a lot of things that they need to learn about the world, and they certainly do, and they do that by watching, and they do that by interacting and by doing stuff and seeing what happens, but that they should come with a very basic but very solid understanding of the physical world and physical objects and how they relate to one another, and the very idea of bigger things and smaller things, and the relationship of size, and the idea that the idea of a container that you put something in it and that thing will still be in there, or the idea that a container is a certain size and there are things that will fit in there and that the things that won't, and that there are all sorts of ways that you can test that understanding, again, by essentially doing sleight of hand and doing something that's completely unexpected. And and you can tell from the way that they react that is not what they expected.
Yeah, no, that's right. You find exactly the same thing when you look at what we call psychological reasoning, which is babies' ability to reason not about objects but agents, so typically people, but it could also be rabbits or tigers or squirrels. And in that area of physical reasoning, again, what researchers in our lab and in many labs around the world are discovering is that once again, babies seem to have a causal framework given to them by nature. You know, what control our actions are our internal states, our goals, our perceptions, our beliefs, our feelings, our dispositions. Dispositions are things, for example, like preferences, you know, if you like chocolate over pretzels or things like that. And what's so interesting is that babies seem to understand that people have things inside them that you never see that control their actions. So they have to figure out what goals mom might pursue or what goals dad might pursue or what goal little sister is pursuing now. You know, filling out all the specifics of what preferences or dislikes mom or big sister might have. They won't know these. They have to learn them. But the very idea that it's internal states that control your behavior and paying attention to what people do to figure out what are their goals, what are their beliefs, how do they control their actions, that's given to them. And babies as little as 5 months of age already show a lot of sophistication in predicting others' actions. So it's the same as in physical reasoning. So for us, we think of all of this as causal reasoning, making sense of the world. And what nature gives you is the causal framework. In the case of physical reasoning, it's ideas like persistence. Objects can't pop out of existence. Objects can't pop into existence. And objects can't occupy the same space as another object. Those ideas are given to them. They need to figure out, given that, how it works. And similarly, in psychological reasoning, what controls our actions is our internal states. And that causal framework is in place very, very early. And what babies are figuring out is all the specifics, you know, of of how this works. Like when mom reaches into her pocketbook and holds a little silver box next to her ear, what's that about? What is she doing? What goal is she pursuing in doing that? And as they get more experience with the world, they figure out, you know, what the specifics are. But the idea that mom's actions are driven by goals is given to them.
Let me introduce again our guest for anybody who may have tuned in the last 10 or 15 minutes. We're speaking with Renee Baillargeon. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Illinois, and for a couple of decades now has been doing the kind of research work that we've been talking about here, and that is trying to get a better understanding of infants and how it is they make sense of the world around them, both the physical world and how it works, and also what's going on in the heads of other people. Questions certainly are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. I guess, to me, one of the reactions I have, one of the things that I think about this is interesting, is that I think that for a long time people had this assumption that animals, for example, other animals, were almost born knowing everything they needed to know. Now, that's something of an oversimplification, because obviously baby animals do learn as they interact with their environment. But it seems that a lot of what they need to know, they kind of come with that. And that we have this idea, though, that humans were different, and that it has been argued, and I don't know how long ago it has been argued, but it had been argued that the baby was the proverbial blank slate. That is, that they were born almost knowing nothing, mm-hmm. and that they had to learn everything about the world. And what I think is interesting about this is it says, well, maybe the differences are not quite so hard and fast between the human animal and other animals. And it's not the case that babies are born the blank slate. They're born with some basic some of these basic understandings that they then work on and elaborate, and they have to learn a lot more. But it's not just an empty vessel that stuff mm-hmm. gets poured into.
Mm-hmm. No, not at all. I mean, the baby, more and more what we're discovering is that babies have this sort of shallow and abstract, but nevertheless very real and very important, you know, causal framework to make sense of the world. And in the case of psychological reasoning, what's interesting is that there is also research being done with non-human primates that's very similar to the work that we're doing with babies. And so far, there seems to be one critical distinction between human babies and non-human primates. So non-human primates are very good at keeping track of the goals of others, the perceptions of others. And that's similar to what babies can do. But what's interesting is that human babies understand that others' beliefs about the world may be wrong, may be inaccurate. And there's no evidence to this date that non-human primates have this ability. So that's kind of interesting. So there's lots of research going on this topic. So our lab was one of the first to show that babies as little as 15 months of age understand that others can have false belief. So what that means is you come home, you put your keys in one drawer, and you go to your bedroom, let's say, and while you're out of the room, your partner sort of, for whatever reason, moves the keys to a different location. So when you come back, where will you look for your keys? So what we showed is that a 15-month-old knows that you're going to go to the wrong location because you believe that your keys are in the first place where you put them, and your beliefs drive your behavior, so this is where you will go. They know that the keys have now been moved, but they understand that you do not, and this is what will drive your responses. So interestingly, there's no evidence that non-human primates can do that. To this day, they have passed successfully no test of false belief. So this is a very complex computational ability to sort of understand that this is reality, the keys are here, but you are functioning with a different or alternative reality, the keys are there. And given this alternative reality, this is what you will do. And this ability to sort of keep in mind two separate realities, the real one and the one that you adhere to, is a complex problem that babies can do, but perhaps not animals. We don't know yet. In our lab, we've now found that this is work by my student Jing He, that even babies as little as 10 and a half to 11 month olds can do it. And now we're looking at babies as young as, you know, 8 to 9 months, and it looks as though they may have it as well. So it's a very early ability. When I present these results at conferences, a typical reaction from my audience is that Champaign-Urbana babies must be some of the smartest in the world. You know, they're so clever and they do well in all these tasks. So this ability to understand false beliefs is linked to the ability to do pretense. So you may know that in the second year of life, it's very typical for babies to begin to engage in pretense with their parents or older siblings. You know, you pretend that you're sleeping. You pretend that the broom is a dragon that you're riding around the living room. So this also requires the ability to represent the broom as the reality and the dragon as the alternative reality. So animals, again, typically never engage in pretense. So these are sort of linked abilities that seem to be present in humans very early on and may not emerge until later, or never emerge at all in the animals. So there's a whole debate going on as to how this research relates to autistic children, for example, because, you know, autistic children have there's a number of ways in which their development is atypical. One of them is that they rarely engage in pretense. Another one is that they typically fail verbal tests of false belief. So what we would like to do, hopefully, and will do in the coming year with collaborator Alan Leslie at Rutgers University, is to begin to look at how autistic children respond in the nonverbal tasks that we use with our babies.
I'm interested in going back a little bit to you were talking about the idea that babies from a fairly young age seem to have this understanding that people, particularly the people around them, I'm sure that the important focus would be parents and siblings, have things going, and I guess the way that I would say, have things going on in their heads, that is their internal stuff that's going on that they can't see that motivates their behavior. Mm-hmm. And I guess the if you ask this question, well, why is it that would be an important thing for even a baby to know? I suppose the standard answer always was something like, well, we have to take into consideration the fact that babies cannot take care of themselves. They are relying on adults to care for them and take care of all of their needs, even though they maybe can't communicate them really well. So for that reason, it's from a very young age, it's important for babies to start to understand how adults think, and because you know it's a matter of that there's so much dependency there that it's really important. It's probably more important for the infant to try to understand how the adult thinks than for the adult to understand how the infant thinks. Is that if you ask this question, well, why from a very early age would it be important for infants, even a few months old, to sort of get this idea that something's going on in mom's head and that it causes her to do certain things, and that it's probably important for me to understand that because my connection with mom is really important. It's my survival. I mean, obviously, that's not something that they could conceptualize, but that in fact, that's what underlies that and might explain why it is that ability would be there from such a young age.
Well, I'm sure you're right. Part of it has to be that, you know, in order to survive, you have to be able to connect with the people around you, to make sense of their actions and so on. But I think that, I think that part of the reason why babies are given this causal framework is that it would be so hard to learn otherwise. It would be very little for babies to learn all of these things because they're not observable. It's sort of a very general framework that babies are given. And once you have the framework, you can fill in all the pieces. But if you didn't know what a goal was, what if you didn't understand what perceptions meant, or that people had beliefs, or didn't understand what feelings were and how they connected to actions, like if you had to figure out all of these pieces, a very small baby with enormously limited information processing resources would have a terrible time learning all of that. So, you know, what I study in my lab, the physical reasoning, the psychological reasoning, is a very, very small part of what babies have to learn. They have to learn to hold their head up, to eat with a spoon. They have to learn how peas taste as opposed to carrots. They have to learn what their toes taste. I mean, they have to learn to crawl, to walk. There's so much they have to learn. They have to learn language. There's like an enormous, you know, array of things they have to learn, what objects there are in the world, which people are, you know, they have to learn to distinguish this grandma from that grandma. So everything, they have so much to learn that nature sort of gave them a leg up by giving them sort of the framework. So all they have to do is fill in the pieces so that they can learn quickly. The psychological reasoning framework that I'm describing, babies apply to humans, but babies also apply to anything that they consider to be an agent. Just like we do, if we see like a little ant crossing the sidewalk carrying a crumb, we say, oh, it's bringing food back to its nest. We attribute sort of goals, perceptions, and so on to anything we consider to be an agent. Think about R2-D2. It doesn't look like a human, it doesn't talk, but it beeps in a way that we see it as an agent. We can communicate with R2-D2. Mm-hmm. You know, Big Bird, Cookie Monster, they don't have to be humans, they just have to be agents. And babies will sort of apply this whole set of reasoning to anything they consider to be an agent. An agent has internal states that control their behavior. We evolved in a world that didn't just have humans in it. It had rabbits you could eat if you could catch them. It had tigers who would eat you if they could catch you. And so this framework, it doesn't, I don't mean to say at all that humans aren't special. They clearly are. But we also can make sense of behavior more broadly, the behavior of agents. And babies, it doesn't really matter if you show them a box that moves by itself or a circle that moves by itself on a computer screen. They, if they perceive them as agents, they will reason about their goals, their perceptions, their beliefs in the same way that we would as adults, in the same way that they do about humans.
Mm. Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, let's talk with a caller here. We do, in fact, have someone in Champaign on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I just tuned in, so I'm not even sure who I'm listening to, but I was wanting to know how if there's a book or anything related to your research that someone like myself who's interested in these things could do further research on my own or get more information.
I'm sorry to tell you, I don't think that there's a book that's sort of describing the research that I'm discussing this morning. Part of the reason for that is that the research changes so quickly that it's very hard to keep up, so to speak. There's many labs around the world doing this kind of research, and it just advances at such a fast rate that there isn't yet a book sort of summarizing findings. But if you email me at the U of I, I'll be happy to send you some summary chapters that you might find interesting.
That would be wonderful.
Well,
is that address going to be given, or how would I do that?
Yes, I can give it to you.
If you want, sure.
Yes, so my email address is R, as in...
As in Renee.
Renee. B as in boy, A-I-L-L-A-R. R Bayard. My name is René Bayard-Jean, so that's the beginning of my name, R Bayard, at UIUC.edu.
Could you repeat the R B A I
L L A R?
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Well, maybe I'd better introduce again the guest in case we have other people who are listening who are not sure who they're listening to. Renee Baillargeon, she's a professor of psychology here at the University of Illinois and has for some time now been doing the kind of research into how it is that babies, infants, make sense of the world around them, has been doing that kind of research. Questions certainly are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I wonder, I'm just thinking about the fact that here now, it's been a few years, but I had the chance to talk with Allison Gopnik, mm-hmm. who was here and gave a talk on campus. And as I recall, she wrote a book. It's called, is it The Scientist in the Crib?
That's right.
It's possible that that might be something that someone would find interesting, at least that looks a little bit at some of the research that's been done on, you know, what it is that babies know and when do mm-hmm. they know it, and it might be the kind of thing that parents would say, oh well, I have done a lot of this kind of observing myself, mm-hmm. but if you're interested in perhaps something of what scientists have done, that might be the kind. It's not a mm-hmm. new book anymore. I'm not sure even how many years it's been out, but. You know, it might be the kind mm-hmm. of thing that people might want to take a look at.
Yeah, it's a good place to start.
Yeah. And otherwise, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we do have another caller here and also someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. Actually, I kind of just missed what you said, what book you recommended just now for a place to start.
Well, the book that I was talking about was the title is The Scientist in the Crib.
Oh, great.
And the author's name is, her last name is Gopnik, G-O-P-N-I-K.
K, mm-hmm. And Andy Meltzoff, I think.
Well, I actually wanted to recommend another book because I heard the previous caller asking if there was a place where she could start. And one of my favorite books is called What's Going On in There? And the author is Dr. Lise Elliott. And I think it's really easy for anybody to read, but it's pretty thorough. So I just wanted to recommend that for anybody who is listening and wanted some book to read. So,
okay, great. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, sure.
We appreciate that.
Okay,
and
thanks.
Other
thank you.
Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. This question maybe is getting off into a different sort of area. This is something maybe more like evolutionary psychology. But do you think it is the case that the kinds of abilities that we've talked about, that is these very basic kinds of understanding about the physical world, that it looks as if babies are, looks like they're essentially born with that. They're ready to go. That gives them a leg up mm-hmm. on all of the things that they have to learn, gives them sort of a basic framework to build on and then go from there. Was it something, do you think, it just in human evolutionary history, did it just appear one day? Was it just there one, not there one day and there the next? Or was it something that you could think of as being an incremental kind of a development, something that sort of came piece by piece? Or is it simply that's just one of those questions you just have to say, well, there is simply no way of answering that question?
Well, I don't know. I'm not an expert in that field at all. I imagine it was incremental over a very long time. And I think that it just had a huge advantage, you know, adaptive advantage to have it, because it means that learning, it sort of makes learning, you know, so much faster. In fact, it probably makes learning possible. And so as we sort of little by little fine-tuned sort of the cognitive apparatus that the baby brought to the task of making sense of the world, each little change sort of made it incrementally better, incrementally more adaptive. And so I think presumably that's what happened over a very long period of evolution. We got to this place where we have sort of many different modules, people often call them, that sort of each is kind of adapted for a particular task. You know, we have a module for physical reasoning, psychological reasoning, language, number. Moral reasoning is another module that people are very interested in. And so sometimes, as Steve Pinker has discussed in his book, like these modules can all be at war with each other. But so all of these abilities evolve to sort of make us better adapted to learn faster about the world around us. The things that I study in babies are things that make it easy for babies to not walk into walls, to put cups on tables so they don't fall off the table, to put large objects in large as opposed to small containers. So they're sort of like the everyday simple manipulations of objects. They don't make it possible to put rockets in space or, you know, build radio stations or even understand how radios work. So cell phones, radios, you know, microwave ovens, you know, nature did not make us, that's not what my babies are sort of, nature did not give them anything to really understand those. The things that nature helped babies understand are sort of the simple everyday manipulations of objects. And but nature did a very good job of sort of endowing them to make sense of that. Last week, we had anthropologists visiting us here at the U of I. There's a team of anthropologists that are sort of led by a philosopher in England named Stephen Lawrence at the University of Sheffield. And they want to try some of our tasks in 15 sites around the world, in China, Ecuador, Africa, Fiji. And they want to, because we all have this assumption that the abilities that we see in small babies, in this case it's on psychological reasoning, but that these are innate. And if they're innate, then they have to be universal. And so it means that if we travel to Ecuador, we should find that babies there understand that others can pursue goals, others can have false beliefs, and so on. So it's very exciting to see, you know, so the anthropologists come here and we show them how we do our tasks with our wonderful Champaign-Urbana babies. And then they will sort of do what they can to adjust the task and do them in these various places around the world. And what we hope to find is that even though the specific goals that people pursue may vary somewhat, of course, from one site to another, the idea that people have internal states such as false beliefs that drive their actions will be universal.
Mm, well, we'll see if the rest of the babies of the rest of the world are as smart as the babies of Champaign-Urbana.
Right.
This remains to be seen. We have a couple of other callers here. Let's talk with someone in Urbana, line two.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask if your guest knew the book by Susan Gelman, The Essential Child, and what her opinion of this particular idea is.
I'm sorry, I have not read the book. I know that it applies to somewhat older children than the ones that I deal with on a day-to-day basis. And I think that Susan's claim is that children understand that objects have essences, right?
Right. And part of the argument, I think, is that there's a hardwired aspect of young children to essentialize particularly animal and humans. So the idea that we, you know, we essentialize sort of gender and or sex and race and so on and so forth, not totally disconnected from words and from culture, but that there is this tendency. And I found the book interesting. I was just, but I'm not a specialist in this area, so I just wanted to ask of a specialist's opinion. That's all. But thank you.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this claim is very related to some of the ideas we're pursuing with babies.
Well, that's what I thought.
Right.
Yeah,
so you're right there. So, for example, some of the notions we study with babies are, what do babies think a self-propelled object is? So when an object sort of starts to move by itself, what do babies make of that? What do they think this object is? What else can it do? So another question might be, what do babies think an agent is? And how do they distinguish? I mean, is every self-propelled object an agent for a baby, or self-propelled object and agent are different notions for babies? And what we're finding is that, in fact, these seem to be different concepts for babies. So a self-propelled object could be a person, but it could also be a ceiling fan, which is not an agent. An agent is someone that can detect its environment and pursue goals, but it does not, in fact, have to be self-propelled. So you could imagine R2-D2 stuck on a wall, never moving, but if it responded to us as we talked to it, you know, through beeps or whatever, we would still see it as an agent. So we study these notions. What is a self-propelled object? What is an agent? What is an animal? And so in that sense, there seems to be, each of these concepts seems to have an essential nature for babies. An animal must meet, to be an animal, you have to meet certain criteria. To be an agent, you have to meet certain criteria. To be self-propelled, you have to meet certain criteria. You're a certain kind of thing. You carry an essence, so to speak. The essences we study are very general ones. We're not studying the essences of being a tree or being an emerald or being a rabbit. We're studying at a much more abstract level these kind of early concepts that babies might have.
Well, thank you.
All right, let's talk with someone in Bourbonnais next. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi. This is a little ancillary, but what progress has been made in communicating with babies directly and in getting them to understand the noises we make and us understanding the noises they make? Hello?
She's considering, she's carefully considering your question.
Yes. I'm not quite sure how to answer your question. I mean, we know better how to, for example, my colleague here, Cindy Fisher, who studies language acquisition in even in the first year of life, like around 9-10 months of age, researchers such as Cindy and others are sort of exploring how babies understand language, and they're getting better and better at teaching babies new words, new nouns, new verbs, and so on. So in that sense, we're understanding better what, you know, universal grammar, what innate structures babies bring to the task of language acquisition. And knowing that, we can teach them words at an earlier age.
Okay. Well, that's great. What about the other way? In understanding the noises they make?
Well, I think there's actually been quite a lot of research on that. Again, that's not my area. I don't quite study language acquisition, but researchers have sort of like described very carefully the various stages of babbling and sort of how you go from babbling to first words to two-word sentences and so on. And I think much of that is understood. Do you not think so?
I don't have very much thought on it at all. It's not my field, and it's just a question that popped into my head as I was listening to you.
All right.
Well, I think it's probably the best answer that we can give you at this point.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We have a couple of minutes left with our guest, Renee Bayerjean. She's a professor of psychology here at the University of Illinois. And it's, you know, we've talked about some of the work that you've done and the fact that babies, there's a lot that they need to learn, so hitting the ground running is probably a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that to have some sort of structures there present in their brains to help them is a good thing. And that now we perhaps have a better appreciation than we have in the past about the fact that they do, in fact, come with some basic knowledge about the world that they do build on. So having said all that, I'm interested in what more would you like to know? What further questions do you have that you would like to have an answer to?
Oh, you know, there's a million more questions that I would like to have answers to. You know, one of the really wonderful thing about my area of research is, you know, I started ages ago, and it's just as exciting as it was the very first day I tested my first baby. As soon as some questions are answered, more come up. And as you realize how sophisticated babies are, you ask, more and more and more sophisticated questions of them as well. So, for example, in our psychological reasoning world, we started with very simple situations where the baby tries to understand, for example, which of two objects an adult will reach for. But now we're starting to ask questions about how agents interact, and do babies have an idea, for example, of an eye for an eye? If I steal your cookie, will you steal my cookie? Do babies have moral reasoning? Do they have a concept of fairness? Do they expect that if I have two cookies and two puppet giraffes to share them with, this is work by my student Stephanie Sloan, that I should give one cookie to each giraffe? So what are babies' ideas about morality? How do they interact with group? If you have, for example, one giraffe that hits a monkey over the head, what will another monkey do to that giraffe? So that would be a notion of co-reciprocity rather than reciprocity. So in the psychological reasoning world, the questions are just endless and sort of relate to the world we live in today. Sort of, why are we so very willing to hurt and kill each other? And what are the sort of the, what are we born with that leads us to see our neighbors as friends or as foe? And how much of this is sort of dyed in the wool so that once we understand our responses, can we better control them with our minds so that we don't live in such a sorry world? So there are so many wonderful questions to ask. In the physical reasoning domain, what we're trying to understand is more precisely the cognitive architecture of how it works and the various systems that underlie babies' responses to the physical world. One of the main thrusts of our research there is to do teaching experiments with Champaign-Urbana babies, where we bring babies to the lab and we try to teach them concepts that they don't already have to see how to facilitate learning, what makes learning possible or not. Yeah.
We're going to have to leave it there, I'm sorry to say, because we've used our time. Our guest is Renee Bayerjean. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.